abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Friday, March 21st, 2014, and Joel Salatin joins us today by popular demand. We'll bring on Joel in just a minute. Don't forget, subscribe to this program. Think of the gems you're missing if you're just listening to a fugitive episode here and there. And thanks so much, you guys, for so many of you subscribing on iTunes and keeping us up there in the charts. That's very, very good and generous of you. The show is free, of course. We broadcast every day, Monday through Friday, for the first time at noon Eastern at TomWoodsRadio.com. And then as a podcast, you can get on iTunes and Stitcher or anywhere else you like to get your podcasts. You can find easy subscription links to subscribe to the program over at TomWoodsRadio.com. Well, right now I'd like to welcome Joel Salatin. He is a third-generation full-time farmer in Virginia's Shenandoah Valley. Polyface Farms is his 550-acre farm. His books include Everything I Want to Do is Illegal, War Stories from the Local Food Front, and Folks, This Ain't Normal, A Farmer's Advice for Happier Hens, Healthier People, and a Better World. Joel Salatin, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom. It's wonderful to be with you.
Let's start off by having you give maybe a two-minute overview of what makes you different in terms of your views on agriculture. Just give people a bird's-eye view, and then we'll go through sort of point by point.
Where do you start? I'm a heretic. So I actually wrote a book, The Sheer Ecstasy of Being a Lunatic Farmer. So let's see here. First of all, we believe that nature provides the template. And so when we look at natural systems, we see them primarily perennial, not annual. And, of course, all of American agriculture worships at the altar of growing annuals, not perennial. It is animal-centric. There is no animal-less ecology in the world. So a farm without animals is probably an oxymoron if it's going to be ecological. Nature is primarily carbon-centric, and carbon doesn't move very far. So our soil fertility is generated on-site rather than from off-site. So the point is to look at solar conversion to biomass and convert it on-site rather than off-site. We believe in hydrating the landscape, that rain is actually water, and we can do things like ponds or, you know, catchments to actually ameliorate flood and drought. If we run a carbon-centric system, we're going to build water retentive capacity in the soil. So our whole principle of farming is one of soil building rather than soil depletion. And eventually, you know, you move on, you actually wear out farms. Our farms should be getting more and more productive. We believe that the default position of nature is wellness, not sickness. In other words, nature is not broken so that we need Monsanto to fix it. Actually, nature runs very well. Thank you very much. If we will approach our foodscape from a humble place of natural patterns, we believe that farms should be a place of bustling people and activity, not abandoned places of a bunch of hermit curmudgeon geezers wandering around with nobody to work with. And actually, most of the Middle Agers working in town to be able to support their farm addiction. We think that typical things on farms that our ancestors used to do, from value adding and things, should be done on farms. That farms should not be just colonial peasants producing raw commodities to be value added and merchandised by smart people in the cities, that actually the wealth of our nation should be centered in rural areas, not centered in urban areas. So, is that enough to, for starters?
I think that should more or less get us going. Well, let me play devil's advocate, as I so often do on this program, to make things interesting. Let me present to you the typical case for what we might call the other side, which would say to you that it's all very nice, the bucolic picture that you paint here, but you know, this is the 21st century, and we have billions and billions of people to feed. And frankly, the practices of our ancestors are simply not up to that challenge. We need we need to use growth hormones for the cows. We need to use to have non-organic practices. We need to use all these pesticides. We need to use all these chemicals if we're going to be able to feed the world inexpensively. Okay, now, I assume I've got you ready to go here. So I've lined this fat softball right over the plate. Let's hear how you handle that, because I honestly am curious. What is the answer to that?
Yeah, well, that is absolutely the most common question I get asked, both in conference speaking and on programs like this, from media, journalists, whatever. Because ultimately, if our system can't feed the world, then it's not credible. And so we have to be able to address that. Interestingly, the last word you used in your litany of requirements was inexpensively. Now, I don't have any problem with everything else except that. You know, the United States right now spends less on food than any other culture in the world per capita. Anywhere in the world, less on food. We spend more on health care than any other country. I wonder if there could be a correlation between those two.
Very interesting.
Is it possible? You know, in the last 35 years, we've exchanged 18% per capita expenditure on food with 9% per capita expenditure on food. And in that same amount of time, we've gone from 9% per capita expenditure on health care to 18%. Those numbers have inverted. I would suggest that there is a correlation between those two. Now, in other words, you can't have your cake and eat it too. I mean, we could go into a bunch of cliches here. You get what you pay for. And there's all sorts of things. The empirical science is in that food like we produce is far more nutritious. It's far superior. Okay. So let's talk about the production itself. First of all, right now, I mean, as we speak, the world is producing twice as much human edible food as is necessary. For the first time in human civilization, 50% of all human edible food never reaches a mouth. That's never happened before. Why is it happening right now? Because for the first time in human history, the average morsel of food travels 1,500 miles from field to fork. During that amount of time, it spoils, it gets blemishes, there are all sorts of problems and issues, and in fact, chemicalization creates all sorts of problems. I mean, in North Carolina, I talked to a lady the other day, lives next to a place where she watches them dump a tractor trailer load of milk every day that's got some sort of problem with it. She lives next to a yogurt plant. And so it could be a little bit of antibiotic residue that tested out. Could be, that it's a little bit funky, spoilage, whatever, sell-by date, whatever. The point is that there is a massive, massive, unprecedented amount of food waste in the world, primarily due to this segregation between farm and plate. So if we go to a local-centric system, shorten that chain of custody, then there is far less waste. That's number one. Number two, our country, just the U.S., what was our country, if you took our boundary line, 600 years ago, produced more pounds of animals than it does today, even with all our chemicals, corn, soybeans, you know, John Deere and everything else. Because there are certain patterns in nature, very intricate, symbiotic, relational patterns in nature. When you break those up and go from multi-speciation with intricate, complex, symbiotic relationships to monospeciation, oh, it makes amazing pictures to watch, you know, eight combines going down through a 1,000-acre field of wheat, and we get this heart palpation and feel real, you know, machismo, like, wow, this is really amazing. But in actuality, there is far less production there per acre than when it was being harvested from tall grass prairie perennials through bison, elk, antelope, wolves, and coyotes. You know, I mean, that is a fact. Number two, the United States has 36 million acres of lawn and 36 million acres housing and feeding recreational horses. That's 72 million acres. That's enough to feed the entire country without one single farm or ranch. In order to tap into that, though, it would require an integrated food system. And right now in our techno-sophisticated culture, we don't view food production, or actually, you know, getting your hands in the dirt, if you will, we don't view that as something that educated white people do. We only view that as something that the lower echelons of society participates in. I mean, you know, sophisticates join soccer leagues and ballet and do all that stuff. Farming is for, dumb people and brown people.
All right, let me play devil's advocate here once again. Mm-hmm. Let's imagine any situation involving international trade. Let's suppose we get a lot of pencils from South America. And on the surface of it, it may seem silly that we would get our pencils all the way from South America. I could make a pencil in a factory down the street, but it could be that the efficiency in producing pencils is so great in South America that it swamps the cost of transportation. The cost of transportation is trivial next to the gains from trade to be gotten from producing pencils in South America. So on the surface of it, what may seem absurd may make sense. So likewise with food, if you've got a profit-seeking enterprise on your hands, why wouldn't they have an incentive to minimize spoilage, to minimize blemishes and waste? If they themselves are enduring it, it must apparently be profitable. It must be worth it to them to even to have all this waste, because the system must be generating enough profits that the waste must be, from their bottom line point of view, trivial. Why is the profit and loss system not translating into the kind of agriculture that you say is the most sensible?
Well, the reason is because the profits are skewed. Right now, the entire system floats on cheap energy. We have never had in the history of mankind, until the discovery, you know, last century of petroleum, we have never had cheap fuel. I mean, whether it was firewood or animal power or whatever, transportation and fuel, energy, were always extremely expensive until today. We're actually mining old, you could say old stored solar energy, in order to create an artificial facade of efficiency. In other words, all the costs, I'm sure you're familiar with the term externalized costs. The supermarket costs are not actually reflected in the price of the product. I mean, we're even willing to send troops to, you know, the Middle East and have our young people shot up and wounded in order to make sure that we have cheap fuel. That's how much we're willing to invest to prop up this crutch of seeming efficiency. And I don't know if fuel is going to continue to be cheap. I don't know, but it seems like it would make sense to do whatever we could to reduce our dependence on non-renewable energies, regardless of how long they're going to last. We shouldn't be just using them up like a bunch of drunken sailors. Prudence would dictate that, hey, we've got this bonanza. Let's use it as gently as possible so it lasts as long as possible.
Joel, let me run this one by you. What about people who say that the interest in organic food and, let's say, a lot of the negative attention that GMO food has gotten is really not justified by the peer-reviewed literature? They say, show me some peer-reviewed literature that shows that people's health is harmed by non-organic food or harmed by GMO-type food. Show me the demerits and show me the benefits of doing it the other way. That they say, yeah, sure, growth hormones may not sound particularly appetizing that you want to have in your burger, but it doesn't seem to really harm human health, and the cost and the price is right. How do you answer that?
Well, how you answer that is, like Teddy Roosevelt used to say, it's really hard to get a person to change their mind when their paycheck depends on believing something else. And so the material that I read, which is very peer-reviewed, shows that there are all sorts of problems. I mean, GMOs alone had 74 reports come out in 2013 worldwide, impugning not only the empirical claims of the industry, but also showing direct links. Let me give you one example just to show you how science is not objective. Science is extremely subjective. It's extremely political. Let me give you one example. When Monsanto was testing GMO potatoes for government approval, they ran a feeding trial on rats, which of course was required by the FDA bureaucrats. And so they set up the experiment very carefully and selected geriatric rats. These were very, very old rats. I don't know if they're rat nursing homes, but anyway, these were extremely old rats. They fed them for whatever it was, 30 days or 60 days, whatever it was, nothing. It didn't show up any changes, any difference. When the exact same experiment was repeated in Scotland with exactly the same parameters, except using juvenile rats, my goodness, there were organ weight differences, behavioral differences, stress differences, emotional differences, all sorts of issues showed up. The point is that you're not going to see a difference in brain function or organ development in a geriatric rat. I mean, they're not growing anymore anyway. And so, and that kind of deception, it has been repeated over and over and over again in all sorts of scientific things. Mother Earth News commissioned a scientific study 4 years ago over 2 years of pastured eggs. I'll just pick one, pastured eggs. Sent them to a lab and found that it took about 12 items, folic acid and riboflavin and cholesterol, different things, in pastured eggs. And compared to what I call the U.S. official label, it didn't even look like the same product. I'll just pick one, folic acid, which is a really important one for pregnant women. The USDA official dietary label is like, 38 micrograms per egg. And our eggs measured about 1,050 micrograms per per egg. I mean, that's off the charts. We've had the same kind of thing happen with grass-finished beef, same thing kind of happen with pork. I mean, we had a chef do a displacement test. He took a bunch of our pork, put it in a beaker of water, a certain number of pounds, measured the displacement, took industrial port from a hog factory did the same thing, and ours displaced way less water than the one from the industrial factory, i.e., ours is denser, more nutrient-dense. The factory stuff is very has no muscle tissue or no muscle tone, and it's slovenly. It's cellulose. It's not nutrition. And so so the tests. I mean, Dr. Don Huber from Purdue University is traveling the world. I think he's speaking virtually every week around the world, showing the devastating effects, including links to autism. Autism is spiking all of a sudden. Why is autism spiked all of a sudden? You know, we've only had GMOs out for about 14 years. This is year 15, I think. And it took 14 years to definitively isolate the DDT connection with infertile frogs, three-legged salamanders, and eagle eggs that wouldn't hatch. It took 14 years for that science to finally catch up for a causation. We're now in the 15th years of GMOs, and there is a juggernaut, a proliferation of studies from around the world impugning not only the claims, but the ill health effects from these. Dr. Don Huber's documented the glyphosate function with spontaneous abortions, infertility. All these things happen. They don't happen in 60 days feeding geriatric rats. They happen over time, and there's an accumulating effect of these. And so the fact is that how you set up the scientific experiment and how long you choose to run the experiment has a direct effect on what the experiment shows. So the people that are saying, where's the science, where are the double blind, they're simply reading the Monsanto pablum. They're not reading the other side. There is a huge portion of the other side, and you just need to take a look at it.
Joel, you have a book called Everything I Want to Do Is Illegal. I love that title. It may be one of the best book titles I've ever heard. I want to say a quick thing about raw milk before I let you go. Can you start off just giving us the one-sentence definition? What is raw milk?
Raw milk is the way it comes right out of the teat.
So nothing. There's nothing done to it. There's no pasteurization done to it.
That's correct. Nothing.
So first of all, that makes me wonder, then what was the point of pasteurization? Why did people celebrate this as a great scientific breakthrough? And we're all taught that we're supposed to admire Louis Pasteur for having designed it and all that. There's nothing to it? That was a step backward rather than forward?
Well, no. What happened was during the late 1800s, from about 1860 and on, as the Industrial Revolution gained steam and the urban sectors became more and more populated, this was all happening prior to refrigeration. And so the way to have milk and breweries, both of these were liquids that, obviously were very fragile without refrigeration. So the breweries and dairies moved into the cities and with confinement feeding, in fact, with the dairies often eating the distiller's grains, the refuse from the beer. And that distiller's grain set up an acidosis in the rumen of the cow, which was very conducive to changing the pH and changing the internal structure of the cow, which made her very prone to brucellosis and all sorts of problems. So there was a period of time there where the dairies were filthy, the milk was filthy. I mean, we were just discovering, bacteria. We were just discovering, we were still debating at that time whether a doctor should boil his surgical instruments between amputations. We were deciding, should you take a bath once a week or once a month, And we didn't have indoor plumbing, stainless steel, refrigeration, none of those things. So there was a slice of time during this extensive urbanization of the country and without refrigeration, without the infrastructure, that created a real problem in the food system. Well, during that time, farms like the Mayo Clinic built its reputation at that time using pastured milk, grass-fed raw milk. That's how they got their start. The Mayo Clinic started at that time using healthy, non-urban, you know, grass-fed cow milk, raw milk, as the antidote to all these problems that people were having. Okay, so fast forward to today. Today, what we have now is refrigeration, stainless steel, electric fences, water pipe, nursery shade cloth, pastured systems, extremely clean hygienic systems, monitoring systems, microscopes, litmus tests, litmus papers you can check, mastitis and all sorts of issues. And so we now have a system in place that is extremely hygienic. I mean, in many countries in Europe, you can put in, euros in vending machines and get glasses of raw milk out of vending machines in the Netherlands and in, other places. And so the food safety laws that were written to be a catch-all kind of thing during this kind of blip in food development and urban development history 100 years ago, those laws are now completely obsolete.
Okay, so they have outgrown their usefulness, and yet they stick around. This seems to be the case with a lot of government laws. They just stick around. There's a whole institution that develops around them and interest groups that develop around them. Why do you think, then, I assume your view that raw milk is not a danger to human health, but yet you're not allowed to exchange, you're not allowed to buy raw milk from your neighbor, you're not allowed to traffic in it. What possible explanation could there be for maintaining this ban?
Oh, because the bureaucrats have all read the 1920s literature, and they're absolutely paranoid. I differ from some of my colleagues on this who think that there's a grand conspiracy and all this stuff. No, it's not a conspiracy. These are sincere-minded, truly, they absolutely believe that if they unleashed raw milk on the population, that we would have, mass death. And nothing could be further from the truth. But that's their mindset, which is why the answer is not trying to convince the government to quit pasteurizing milk. Forget that. All we need is a food emancipation proclamation to de-enslave food from the Inquisition that's being foisted upon you and I in denying us the freedom of food choice, the freedom to choose the food of our choice from the source of our choice. And if we would allow people to actually own their own bodies again, in other words, I'm responsible for me, not you, not the government, not somebody else. If we could allow people to have the freedom to be responsible, if they wanted to be. If they don't, then absolutely go get the U.S. Get the pasteurized, government approved source. That's fine. But if you want to opt out, if you want to be a heretic, if you want to be on the lunatic fringe, how a culture treats and handles its innovative lunatic fringe absolutely defines whether a country is a tyranny or a place of liberty. And a country that cannot abide some loose cannons around its edges is a country that is vapid, timid, paranoid, and operating on fear rather than faith.
And isn't it funny? That's exactly how they describe the so-called lunatic fringe, with those very adjectives. But perhaps they ought to turn that magnifying glass on themselves. Well, Joel Salatin, how can people find out more about your work?
Well, our website is polyfacefarms.com. You can just search us in at Polyface. By the time you get to Polyface, it'll pop right up. We have a very active website, blogging, a lot of information, where I'll be speaking, and I would invite, all your listeners to come and hear me when I'm going to be in their neck of the woods. I travel a lot and speak. And, of course, our books are there. We have 9 books. And so if any of this tickles your ears, there's a lot of material there to enjoy.
Well, Joel, thanks so much for taking some time with us. This is an area that I know a little bit about, but I wanted to hear how you, whom I consider one of the really authoritative sources on this, would handle sort of the standard objections, and I'm grateful for that. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, everybody, that's Joel Salatin. Don't forget, every weekday, get your daily dose of fun and liberty education by subscribing to The Tom Woods Show over at TomWoodsRadio.com. I will be speaking at Florida Southern College on April 9th, at Liberty University on April 10th, and in Provo, Utah on May 9th. You can find out more about those events on my events page on my personal site, which is TomWoods.com. The events page is TomWoods.com/events. You guys are helping me stay on the air at no cost to yourselves by entering Amazon through the little Amazon widget we have at TomWoodsRadio.com, and I certainly appreciate that. Before I let you guys go, I just want to say a little something about this free ebook I'm giving to all you guys. Everybody who listens to this program can get a free ebook coming soon of transcripts of all the exciting interviews we did in 2013. So you put that all together, imagine the information at your fingertips. You don't have to go through all the programs and find that one fact that you wanted to get. It'll be right there at your fingertips. I'm giving it away for free. It's just taken me a little extra time because we did have a baby a little early and all that, and so it'll be probably 2-3 more weeks, but it'll be ready, and you'll have to listen to this program to find out how to get your free copy of that. But what I find so interesting and great and heartwarming is something that I think kids in this generation won't appreciate because they grew up with the internet and it all just seems normal to them. But I was able to hire somebody in Japan to do this for me, because I don't know how to lay out an ebook. And I don't want to take the time to learn, frankly. And so I sent her this 200,000-word manuscript last night, and she got it basically instantaneously and started working on it, and it has sent me a draft already. This amazes me. You know, what a world we live in. How exciting. I found her on a site called Elance, elance.com. How interesting. A wonderful way to bring the whole world together. Absolutely great. All right, I'm getting sappy. That's an indication that we are at the end of another programming week. Subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. We got a lot of great programs coming next week, and we'll see you then.
The Tom Woods Show.